This is Infidel One. Offending Coyote Down. Offending Coyote Down.
Roger that.
Welcome to Trappin' Radio. We're proud, organic, free-range, wild fur farmers of North America.
Let me tell you a little story about how I was raised. Every day work, every day pray. Got family, friends, yeah, everybody sins. A winner never quits, and a quitter never wins. Help folks in need, don't fall for greed. A jealous man is weak, so think before you speak. If you love them, let them know. If you hate, let it go. Fast can be fun, but sometimes you need slow. God is all good, the devil is so real. So listen up, y'all, cause this is how I feel.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got none. Except for the good Lord up above. I answer to no one.
Now let's cover our sponsors. They do a lot to help support Trappin' Radio. So I'm asking you guys out there and gals to help support our sponsors as they keep Trappin' Radio on the air. First sponsors, Oki Cable and Trap Supply. Jeb's the owner of this. He's out of Oklahoma. Super guy. You'll not meet anybody nicer. It's somebody you're going to want to deal with. You can reach him at oktrapsupply.com. You can give Jeb a call at 918-429-4648. Not only does he do trap supply guys, he's a fur buyer, so if you're around the Oklahoma or surrounding states, give him a call with your fur. When you need stuff, give him a call and he'll get it out to you as soon as he can. Our second sponsor is F&T Fur Harvesters Trading Post. Everything you need for trapping, hunting with hounds, and predator calling. Guys, if you're into trapping fur, hunting fur, chasing fur with dogs, you're not going to be able to think of hardly anything that you can't get from F&T. You can reach them at fntpost.com. You can also give them a call at 989-727-8727. Whatever you want, F&T's got. Wildlife Control Supplies. Proven solutions for wildlife control. Delivering value, expertise, and products to the wildlife individual. If you're in the ADC business, control business, even fur trapping, you need to look at these guys' website. Top-notch company. Have everything you would want, even the odd stuff that ADC guys are looking for. You can reach them at wildlifecontrolsupplies.com. You can give them a call at 877-684-7262. International number is 860-844-0101. If you're a wildlife control professional, you need to have Wildlife Control Supplies as one of your favorites on your computer or your phone, because when you come across something that you need specialized equipment, Alan will get it right out to you.
Now let's go trapping.
See, I'm a flag flying, Bible toting son of a gun. Yeah, I'm hell on the heart, just a rebel on the run. Scared, don't know it, fear, don't feel it. The truth is the light, sometimes you gotta fight. Good beats bad, right beats wrong. I'm a barroom preacher and this is my song. I'm climbing for the top, representing for the country. I'm the people's champ, right out to dead camp. Shotgun toter, Republican voter. Hank Jr. supporter, let's protect our border. To hell with anyone who don't believe in the USA. Cause this is what I say.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got...
Hello everybody, this is Clint Locklear from Trappin' Radio, coming to you from the PCG compound in Trappin' Readerville. And we're down in a little bit of the south with some awesome news for some of y'all. Probably are going to care less, but we finally got some rain. We really needed around here. So I'm pretty pumped about that. I do need to give a little bit of a warning about the night show. I had a root canal done a while back. The dude screwed it all up. I mean, all up. So to say I'm a little bit on pain medication is an understatement. So if I get out of control on something or say something that may be not right, I'm going to plead the fifth on that. just for the simple fact that I'm pretty drugged up right now. But it's time to do the show, so I'm going to be doing the show. So I hope nothing gets too crazy with it. But that's just a fact, guys. And because if I get on a subject today, I'm debating whether to do it or not, but just because of that issue. So that's the reason I'm even bringing that up. But I want to remind everybody that I'm going to be at the New York show this year. So if you're up around that area, I'd love to come see you. And I got a note from Jeb at Oki Cable and Trap Supply. And I have not seen these traps, guys. I have not. But he was saying that he's going to have a trap that he thinks is going to be a very big deal with fox, bigger coon, even coyote, stuff like that, that's going to be on the market this year. And it is a Duke Square Jawed number 2. Now, I've not seen it. I've not played around with it or whatever. But he says that the trap's put together extremely well and seems to function very well. And he's going to have them at the FTA Kansas show coming up here in a few weeks, which I'll also be at that. So if you're in the area, you can think about coming to that one. But these things apparently are coming four-coil base-plated, and Jeb's actually took it a step further so you can have a fully modified one of these traps laminated. Now, you're not going to be able to get them from anywhere else unless they're laminating them. So he's going to have a little bit extra. It will cost a little bit more, but not very much per trap to have that, because he had someone that was a professional welder put this on there. And he's going to have those at the show in Kansas. And I don't know how much these things have actually went around to different dealers or not yet. But if you're curious about a low cost, apparently it looks, the way he sounds, it looks like almost a copy of a Bridger number 2, which I know a lot of you guys use. That thing's been around since I've, been into trapping. And it's a good trap. If this thing functions like that and everything, at the price that he was kind of hinting around at, that's a big deal as far as whether, you might want to pick some of these things up. But go by Jeb's booth out of Kansas. That way you can lay your little grubby hands on them things, play around with it and see what it is. I did get the feeling from talking to Jeb that if you're going strictly after going to be in a lot of gray fox area or just red fox, it may be too strong for just that, because apparently these coils they have on here are powerful. So, keep that in mind when you get the trap. And the reason I'm telling you that about how powerful this trap is, so if you were just to, call up Jeb and say, send me a dozen, and you didn't get the laminated ones, you really should, because if they are that strong, guys, you need to have the lamination. Because when you have a really strong trap, and without having lamination, you, the trapper, are causing damage, and there's no reason for that in the modern world that we live in. There's just none. For all the practical reasons of that, the few extra dollars per trap to get them laminated, if you're going to have one that strong, I believe as an ethical trapper, you should do everything you can not to just go out and cause damage. So if it's as strong as he's leading me on to be, that's the reason he went ahead and started laminating these things. And if you don't know what that means, it's an extra bar or a piece of cold roll, and it's normally welded on the outside of the jaw. And all that does basically is extend the jaw width. So just think of it this way. If I hit you with a knife, it's going to cut you. If I hit you with a baseball bat, it's not going to cut you. It's just going to hit you. And that's kind of what you're thinking about doing with it, having the extra lamination on a wide, to have these wide jaws. So when all that force comes in contact with the animal, it's dispersed over a bigger area. And, I think that's a good deal on any strong trap regardless. But Jeb went the extra step. I don't know if anybody else in the country is going to have these things already laminated. You can laminate them yourself. We've talked about this in the past, but when you really put the, unless it's just something you really like to do and tinker and different things like that, the money saving is hardly anything, and the time you're spending on it, you could probably be spending on something that's more productive, either within or without trapping. So just keep that in mind when you see a little bit of the price difference there. So just stop by his booth out in Kansas, and you can lay your hands on them and see what you say. I know I am, because I haven't seen one yet, and I'm always like playing around with new traps. So there we go. Now I'm going to start with a couple of emails. And depending on where we're at, is I'm not going to say where we're going yet, because I'm still deciding on one thing or not if I want to get into this. But I got a email from somebody. He'll know who it is. And he said, Clint, I picked up a few ADC Beaver jobs after working on weekends. What PCG lure do you recommend for hot-ass Arkansas this summer? Or just set in trails and runs and wait them out. Either way is fine. I have all day. Ha ha. Well, the thing about lures, I'm going to go through this a little bit, and this is based off my experience in hot southern summer places. And I want to go through this in a set of steps. Now, I do have lures that I use more in the summer than I do in the winter, because they seem to pick up extra beaver, you know, because it just seems to play them a little different. And that is normally starting off with, I will always use some Delta Red just because it'll pick some up really quick. But the more summertime lures is the Beaver Buffet, which is a food lure, and you'll know if a beaver's been there because he'll take the stick. I mean, he literally eats the whole stick. That's how you know it's a food lure. Not just because someone says it's a food lure, but they actually eat it. The other one is Flat Tail Call. It is somewhat of a food lure, but it's more of a curiosity type thing. In the summer, it does very well, even though it does very well in the winter. And the other one is Damage Complaint. I normally hold that one out to the very end. It's a very strange odor to me and you, but a beaver knows what it is because they do eat it. When they get around real nice high-end subdivisions and people start crying great big alligator tears when they start eating this plant. So I know that works very well. So that's what I would recommend right off the bat. But forget about all that for a second. Let's go through the process of doing summertime beaver work. Now, you're dealing with beaver that, just like coyotes, are not moving the same as they do in the summer. So you're dealing with a population just like coyotes, if it's you know, on up into June, July. So if you're on a stretch of water or something like that, you're gonna have a section of beaver that know everything that's going on in their waterway. The only way this is gonna change, if you have a very high beaver population and you're on moving big water, but it's still not gonna be that drastic, because you may have four or five different houses of four or five different beaver that may play on the same water, but they know exactly what's going on. There's not a whole lot of flooding and changing and, you know, all that stuff going on. So they pay way more attention. Plus, they have baby beaver to think about. So they're being more protective and they're being more cautious, just like any other animal would be when there's babies involved. So all that plays into this. So normally when I'm going to do a beaver job, I start out kind of the opposite of the way that I do with coyotes. I go with the least amount of visual, the least amount of disturbance, and the least amount of any type of odor whatsoever when it comes to summertime beaver. And what I'm trying to do is I'm just basically working through these things, and I'm trying to get it where I can snag as many of the beavers I can without them knowing I'm there. Now, at some point, they're gonna know you're there anyway. So because of that, it's not like this will work all the time. Now, if you have all the time in the world, it definitely will. But a lot of times your expenses and stuff get caught up with you. So when I first go into a place, and I'm telling you this as a lure maker, guys, leave the lure in the bag. So I go to a new place, and I'm gonna first look around. This is one of those, unlike fur trapping, you go up to a creek, there's beaver on there, or you get to a section of river and you know there's beaver on there, and you can slap in a couple of caster sets or feed sticks, or you know, slather up the bank in one way, whatever your super sauce is that you're gonna be doing with your super set that works in the winter. Especially in the spring, you'll have a lot more beaver flowing back and forth. You have a lot of smaller beaver that don't really know what's going on, so they're getting tagged. But you just go to where you can physically put the set in. Summertime beaver is a little bit different than that. So the first thing you have to do is scout. You need to do this with very little disturbance. So if you find a beaver house, don't climb up on it, start jumping up and down and doing cartwheels and stuff like that. Don't do anything to disturb it. Don't go out and just start walking across dams if it's going to screw up the dam. You don't want to do anything. You want to be a ghost. Pretend that you're in some fantasy video game, and if you make too much noise or make too much disturbance, the alien comes out of the sky and spears you with something that's really dull and it's going to hurt real bad. Be a ghost. So what you're going to want to do is whatever the body of water or all the body of water you can get, you want to physically scout that out. The easiest way to do this, if possible, is a canoe or a kayak. You're not going to disturb the beaver, and you're not going to put them on high alert by doing this. So if you're on a river or big pond, you're better off, if you can, to get in the canoe or kayak. You know, that way you can go around the coast of what it is. There again, this is going to depend on size. And you're going to look for, you know, what are possibly active beaver dens, old beaver dens, because they may come into play later. You're going to look if they've got any of the creeks blocked up that are coming into the body of water. Where are they feeding? You know, look at the plants. If you see a place that's got a bunch of the different lilies or cattails or some of the big lilies down the south, like when you think of the bass fishing, they will pull those up and eat the roots, and they'll be floating around like muskrats. So you're trying to figure out in your mind, what is the beaver doing? You know, he's coming out. Is he going to, do the dams look like they're being refreshed? Are they old? Are they still holding water? Is water running through it and the beaver just don't care? You know, you're wanting to figure out this. You know, are they going, staying more on one side of the lake than the other side? So you're trying to come up with this mental image of what kind of the beaver are doing. Instead of just thinking, guys, hey, there's beaver here. I'll put a set out there, going to come find it. In the summertime, that doesn't necessarily work out very well. So the next thing I do is even if I've got to go back, if I'm in a canoe or I'm walking, and if you're walking, you know, just don't practice a little bit of woodsman skills here. You know, don't go through there, you know, just, you know, making a bunch of noise. You don't want to be on the side of the banks in the summertime, if it's especially the smaller the body of water, you know, muddying up the banks and kicking into every hole you see and stuff like that. You've got to use some common sense when you're dealing with summertime beaver. So then I will go back and I'll have a plan. Now, as I'm looking at everything and I'm looking at what I may have to do on the place, I'm kind of thinking, okay, there's a creek coming in and I can see where beaver occasionally or sometimes, hopefully more than once a week or whatever, will cross that dam. Now I've got to think, do I have otters to contend with or different things like that? Am I having a big turtle population I have to deal with? That's going to really make a difference on what type of piece of equipment that I use. If I've got to do a lot of walking, you know, do I want to drag in a bunch of big footholds to do that with, or can I do it with a snare? Or can I come in with a foothold, I mean a body grip and do it? There's a lot more chess playing going on with summer work than there is winter work when it comes to beaver. So then I'm going to be thinking, okay, I can remember there's a, you know, there looks like where the active den could be, and I'm going to avoid that particular area like it has got the clap and it's going to jump out and get me. So I'm not going to get anywhere around where I actually think they're denning at. I'm not going to go put a set in their hole. I'm not going to go try to find the runs coming out of their den and plug it up with 330s like you would do in the winter. Remember, it's a binarial disease and you don't want it, so you don't get around it at the time. You're going to get a shot later that's going to allow you to have superhuman strength, which is going to allow you to go back into that binarial disease area and you won't get in trouble. So, but that's not right now. So then I'm going to start out on the outside of this thing, outside of the binarial disease, which is where they're living and denning. And I don't want to get sick, so I'm not going there. And then I'm going to see a couple places they're coming up on the bank probably. They may be going up to a cornfield or a soybean field, or it's getting ready to be the time they go up to the cornbean, soybean, because it's almost getting ripe, you know, for them to start eating on it. I'm going to be looking at all the different type set locations that I can pick up. And then I'm going to go in and I'm going to set the most obvious ones. Not all of them, the most obvious ones that seem like there's more activity than anything else. Because beaver guys, if you've never been around them in the summer and it's the first time you're getting a job, they're not that active a lot of times. And it really depends on the population. If you just got an old male or an old female in there, they don't care about what you're going to be doing. Anyway, with the dams, they'll let the whole thing almost completely dry up before they actually take any action. Now, if there's a family unit and you see a bunch of small trees chewed on and it looks like sawdust everywhere and there's runs going up and down the bank everywhere, now you're dealing with young ones, and that'll come into play as far as what you're doing, because they're going to be really, really easy to catch for the most part. There's a lot of old myths out there about, you know, the small beaver don't go out as far away from the den. All that's crazy, as long as they're, you know, bigger than a muskrat. So that doesn't play in anything. So you're looking around. You're going to pick the most obvious places that you can set that seems to get the most action without using any type of lured set. So that could be, you know, looking at the way the banks, is there a bottom edge set you can set up? Does it look like they're going around a tree on a high bank? Is there a way to block that down where it looks very natural? You're looking at all this and you're coming up with a game plan in the back of your mind. So then you're going to go out, in my opinion, you're going to get those most likely places and you're going to blind set them. Blind set can be with a snare, it can be with a conibear, it can be with a foothold. Doesn't make any difference. But you don't want to use any lure. You want to do as little disturbance as possible. If it's going to be real sloppy and muddy, try to get, you know, away from it when you get down in the water. Because an older beaver, once they realize that someone is after them or their kids, they're extremely smart. Well, I'm not sure I'm going to use the word smart. What's a better word here? Their instincts make them very leery of anything that's out of place. So you don't want to be, if you're going to go like walk down and put a, you see a place where it looks like they could go between a log and a high bank, or you think there's a run down there, don't waller down there like a big old pig and have 450 footsteps and mud slathered all over the place and different things. Because if you do catch a beaver there and you've got all that human sign, now you're giving the beaver a way to connect the two. And this is bad juju to an ADC trapper, because an adult beaver that has possibly survived a sloppy trapper before, when he sees all the human disturbance and someone's jumping up on their dam and their house and, you know, whatever's going on, they go to ground. And by ground to a beaver means in their den. And I've had beaver that will stay in a den without coming out for over 2 weeks. Now I want you to think about what that's going to do to your psyche when you're going back to check that trap. So you're going to be going back. You're not, you've caught a beaver, and all of a sudden now there's no action. So the first response that a trapper that has not experienced this before that they do is they start putting out more sets. And I'm a really big believer that when things aren't working right, you put out more sets, except for this situation. So if nothing happens for 4 or 5 days and you have good sets on good locations that are blind sets and you can see nothing has went through there, you're going to have to make a decision at that point. My decision normally is I'm going to pull my gear and I'm going to leave. 100% I'm going to leave. I'm going to tell the landowner, look, they figured out we're after them. So they're probably not going to come out of the den for several days anyway. Instead of me coming back and looking at empty traps, and you're always going to be calling me, did you catch anything or something like that, to cause all that stress not to be around us, let me just pull them and I'll come back in a couple of weeks and I'll be a lot more sensitive about how I set the traps in. And that's what I'll do. Now, if you can't do that because of a contract or something, you're just going to have to muscle your way through the aggravation of not seeing a lot of action till they come back out. So the first thing I want to do is go in like a ghost. I want to stay away from the binarial area of the denning area. I want to set in blind sets totally with no lure, no caster, no secret sauces, nothing, very little disturbance, and I want to pick up what I can that way first. Now, once that goes through, and that may be half the beaver, that could be two or three beaver, could be one beaver. Once it's clear that that's kind of played its game, then I will go into maybe a couple of caster sets. Maybe where the creek comes into a pond or something like that, which is in more of a natural area. I'll put in maybe just one or two, that's it. Not great big things, not because I can only assume, because I've never got a beaver to actually let me interrogate them. But it seems to me that if you go into a small area and they know the beaver and you're using a lure or something or a smell from another beaver, and you go in and you make this monstrous caster mound set, you know, to a beaver, I can only assume that it's thinking that the Godzilla beaver that's going to whoop everybody's butt is now in the area. Now, they definitely ain't coming out of their hole if they can help it. You set that situation up as the ADC trapper. So when you're going to put in caster mounds, they're small. And by small, I mean no bigger than a flattened out softball. That's it. And you want to, you know, slick up the bank a little bit. I'll go as far when I do summer work that I won't do when I do winter work, is I will take a stick and I'll make sure that it looks like toenail marks are going up. I want it to look as authentic as possible. A lot of times you'll pick up an older beaver, even some of the smaller beaver, at one of those. Now what normally happens, by this point, you're going to go back to the pond and you're going to see a bunch of little caster mounds all around the pond or an enclosed body of water. You can set every one of them up to your tongue's hanging out and you raise the water level of the pond 50 feet and you're not going to catch a beaver on there. They're not coming back to those. And it seems to be more of a challenge or a warning, or this is our territory or something like that. So all of a sudden they realize they think there's another beaver in the area. Something happened to one of their family members. They're seeing this fresh caster. They come out and they make all these little bitty caster mounds. And a lot of times there'll be, like on a stretch of bank on a pond, there'll be 8 or 10 of these little things. You can see where they come out of the water, and I've done it. You go put a snare in their little trail, or you go put a foothold, and it's just a waste of time. So when you see all these little bitty caster mounds pop up, that's letting you know that they know that, or they think they know that another beaver's in the area, and they're trying to, I guess, with gentle measures, tell them that they're not wanted. But once they make these little things, it's like putting the road sign up on the side of the road. They're not going to come back to it. So keep that in mind. And then I will go towards some of the lured sets, which are usually just smeared sets. Sometimes it's lured on the side of a stump or just smeared on the bank. I'm not doing any more caster mounds once I see all those little bitty caster mounds show up, because I don't really think they're caster mounds. They're more of a warning or something like that anyway. And I will go through this process until I start having to get really creative with the whole thing. So the reason I'm going through all this, if you've never done a lot of beaver work, and there's a lot of guys that do, you know, that's one of the easier things in certain states to get some ADC work coming in, is beaver work. You have to think about what you're doing, because everything you do has consequences when it comes to summertime beaver. Now, a lot of people will think that a messed with summertime beaver is the hardest thing to catch. And that can definitely be true. I mean, I've had some beaver that's done some really weird stuff. I've had them where if they thought that they come into experience, that they've seen something before and someone disturbs a beaver dam and they think there could be a trap there, I've been there early enough in the morning where I can see them little things come out of the water 10 feet on the upward side of a dam, walk way out in the woods, and then go down the bank where there's no reason for them to go down the bank. And the very next morning, they go on the other side. They won't even use those same trails again. So they can be, it seems like, very intelligent to stay alive. You know, so what you're wanting to do is you're wanting to tag as many of them as you can before they know you're there. And then you've got to go to work and start getting more creative. And if this is one of those learned things, this is one of those, when otter prices are decent, this is where, if you're going to be a summertime beaver guy, you really should get into the otter side of trapping, even though you're not getting paid for them and all that type of stuff. And the reason I'm telling you this is otter trapping will force any trapper to learn a lot about blind sets. They will force you to be more observational in your area, because otter do not leave the same great big billboard signs like a beaver does. But the biggest reason, it forces you to start understanding blind sets on a whole different level than an average beaver guy is not ever going to be considered with, because he's going to go in at the right time of year and throw in some lure and some caster mount sets, and he's going to be doing that over a great big area, and he's going to have a good success of daily catch of beaver, so that his education kind of stops there. If you're going to try to catch a lot of otter, you're going to have to figure out how to choke stuff down by not screwing with it, with the way the beaver perceives someone being after them. You got to get very creative, because if you're going to start getting good at otter, they're going to be going around things in different ways that a beaver would, and you're going to start picking up all these things. Because what will happen, the reason I say this is important to you, if you're going to be getting into beaver, you need to be good at otter trapping. When you start screwing with a beaver, they go to these secondary locations like the otter do as primary locations. They may not just go right down the middle of the creek anymore once they're under pressure. They all of a sudden now, they could be just like an otter where they're hugging a high bank under roots and stuff like that because they feel safer. You know, so keep all that stuff in mind when you're thinking about the beaver work. But the three that I use is the beaver buffet, the flat tail call, and the damage complaint. That's the three main ones that I use in the winter, and I won't use much, but I'll put a couple of caster mounts out with Delta Red and different things like that. Now, some of the more subtle things you can do to get a beaver's attention is, and I think we've talked about this before, is to really think about how a beaver sees stuff. So instead of using lure on what I'm getting to say, you're going to have to, sometimes you may have to take a 5-gallon bucket to go have enough of this somewhere to go use. But what you're looking for is the places where the leaves and debris settle out on the bottom, and it's that real stinky, mucky black stuff with rotted leaves and everything down in it. That's got a ton of phosphorus, and apparently beaver can see phosphorus. So if you've got an area where beaver has been going up into some trees to feed or something like that, but it may not be the most obvious place that they're using right now, you can take that bucket where you get that all that real loose stuff, because it's going to be hard to carry around unless it's right at the base where you're going to be working. And you can put that in a bag or whatever you're going to do, and smear just all of that black gunk stuff all up and down a slide or in an area. And beaver really respond to that. And it, apparently they can see the phosphorus coming off of that. And when they see it, it looks like a beaver's done it. It has a different odor than everything else around it. And the beaver really respond. Now see, that's not technically a blind set, but in a way I guess it is. You know, and if the creek or the pond, and I can get some of that stuff, I will definitely do a set like that. So you're going to be in Arkansas in the summer, dude, I feel for you. But, be safe out there. Try not to get into too many alligators or copperheads, or it's definitely the water moccasins out there that you'll be dealing with, no doubt. So I'm going to get to another question real quick. And let's see. This is a great question. Remember we did a show a while back, and the question that I was trying to get you to start thinking is you start asking the right question. This is a right question. You've been a student and you've been an instructor. What have you seen or learned that a student can do to get most out of the time taking instruction? And what are some things that you've seen or learned to prevent a student from getting the most out of their instruction time? This is from Al. Al, that is the right question. Absolutely, it's the right question. So basically, because we talked about instruction last week, so the two questions here are: what can a student do to make sure they get the most out of instruction, and what do you see that students do that they get the least out of the instruction. Well, the most, what I've noticed is you need to have an open mind. You don't need to filter everything you're hearing through your own personal experience over something. Now, see, that's important because you're going to learn from somebody and they have probably seen things you haven't seen, and they're going to be bringing those up, or maybe not bringing it up verbally, but that could be causing them to do different things and they don't even realize they're doing it anymore. But if you're stuck on, this is the way that I do it, how come you don't do it the way that I do it? You get, you miss a lot of the value that's there. Now, the other thing that I can tell you is a big help to the instructor, and it'll definitely make a big deal. When you know you're going to be taking instruction, let's say that you called up Trapper Billy Bob, wherever, and you know in August you're going to be taking instruction and it's June. Well, this is one of those times you need to either have an app on your phone that you can take notes, and you need to call that thing like Trapping Instruction Questions, whatever you want to call it. And then every time you think of a question while you're watching TV, while you're out, you know, at your kid's softball game, whatever's going on in your life, your brain will automatically start going through these questions. And you have enough time that you'll be amazed what you think about. You'll see something on a trapping form and you'll go, oh, well, that doesn't make sense. I wonder why they're saying that, or does that really matter, this, that, and the other. Write that down inside your notes. If you're not using a smartphone and you're going to be still using pen and paper, get you a little 3x5 card that you can stick in your back pocket like a wallet, you know, one of those little 3-ring binders that you can get at Walmart for like $2 or $1, and start writing questions out. And the reason for this is, and I can tell you, if you're taking instruction for somebody you look up to, you're going to be in a different mindset, at least at the beginning, than you will be by half the first day or the second day. Because, you know, you're watching somebody that you've listened to or whatever, and they're explaining instruction, they're putting in traps, and there's a little bit of, you know, this is really cool stuff going on, and your brain is not exactly in the absolute learning mode at that time. Plus, you're in a different environment, different things like that. The notes or the questions, however you want to say that, is so important to someone taking instruction. So when that person is in between, because most of the best instruction usually comes when you're not at a set. It comes in between sets, to be honest with you. So if you've got that notebook and after, you know, 3 or 4 hours, and you know they're doing a set, start flipping through those notes, keep them fresh in your mind, and you can bring them up. Now, why this is important, normally what I can tell you from giving a lot of instruction, by 10 or 11 o'clock on day two, the student is burnt. They're mentally burnt. And you can ask people that's taking instruction from me. We go over stuff in a lot of detail, talking about a lot of experiences and talking about a lot of stuff that I learned from other people giving instruction. So it's not just like this is a dirt hole set, we're going to remake the dirt hole set. Now, I guess someone could give instruction that way. That's just not the way I've done it. But what I've learned is by 10 or 11 on day two, they're totally and mentally burnt. Now, they go through the motions. They're tired. They're mentally tired is what it is. It's usually not physically tired. It's mentally tired. And then the subjects get a lot wider and you start talking about all kind of different things. With the notes, when you start hitting that phase, now you've taken, since you're going to take instruction, you know that's going to happen. That definitely happened with me the first time I went out with O'Gorman. It was just so much information from so many different other people he's learned from. My brain went into meltdown by day two, and I was there for a week. Luckily, he said to bring questions. And that allowed me to go through that notebook, and I could go, well, what about using a second trap for an example? Or, you know, what about when your gloves get dirty? Whatever the question is, it doesn't really matter. You know, about, you know, particular locations, or does the animal approach from uphill or downhill at a set? If so, why are we doing a set this way? all of that type stuff can be inside of that notebook. Once you hit meltdown stage, you can just open it up and go, oh yeah, I was going to ask that question. Hey man, what about this? And then y'all go into that and you can write that down. Now, I've seen a lot of students of mine take notes. I don't know if they go back and look at them a lot or not. I really don't know. But I know a lot of them have taken notes. If you're a note taker, then you can give maybe a short answer to one of these questions that you're asking. That way you'll remember enough of the answer so when you need that information, you can go back and find it. But the reason the questions are so important is when you go to take instruction, you need to have a focus on what you're wanting to learn. And that way you can help keep you on track, which will help keep the instructor on track. Because if you're, let's, for an example, you're going to come to me and we're going to take beaver instruction. And you're in a state that can't use snares. And I'm using snares a lot at the particular time that we're going out to do some work. Well, if you just let me do my thing and you don't keep me on track that you can't use snares, are you really going to get the full amount of the information that you should have gotten? Probably not. So, you know, keep that in mind too. And you need to have a focus from your own point of view of why you're going. And what this will do is this will set your mind up in a totally different way than blindly going into something. So to me, having your questions, your concerns, your observations you're not sure about, different things like that, that should be in hand before you start this thing. Because if you end up with somebody like Randy, example, taking instruction, and you're not in very good physical shape, by noon the first day, not only are you probably going to be mentally burnt, you're going to be physically burnt. And when you're tired, you don't think as well, because he is literally an ever-ready bunny that's got a nitrous button that whenever time he sits, gets out of the front seat of his truck, it kicks some nitrous into him. It is amazing to watch. But if you're not physically fit to be able to handle that with him, you can see why you would forget why you were there. So take notes before time, and then when you start getting some downtime, you start bringing these things up to him. And that way you get your questions answered. That's the main thing. That's the most, you know, best advice that I could give somebody on this. Now, what causes most... There's a couple of things that I've noticed, and I've gave a lot of instruction over the years. The first one is the student wants to impress the instructor by telling them how he does everything or how he would do everything. Not in an educational point of view, but in a more of an egotistical point of view. So, you know, well, I would sit there, and then he would go into a whole rant of why he would sit there, and you'd go, I wouldn't sit there because, but I would because, and then this would go on. Now, see, there's no learning there whatsoever. Or if he watches you put in a certain type of set and he wants to get down and show you how he would do it, my question that I've never asked a student because it would be rude is, why in the hell are you taking instruction? Because you're not listening to what I'm saying, because your brain is automatically going into, well, this is how I do it mode. So you're not even listening to the instructor. You're already trying to come up with a response on something of how you can do it. Most of the time, it's to try to impress the instructor, and a lot of people seem to be that way in nature anyway, where no matter what's brought up, they automatically got to top it. That's a wrong attitude from instruction. That is not what you're there to do. If it is, I mean, you're spending a lot of money most of the time just to hear yourself talk. And what most instructors will do, because I've talked to some of them, and I've done this before, after a while, we just figure it's a waste of time to bring up a lot of stuff. Because all it's going to be is about what the student has done before. Well, the student didn't come here to talk about what he did before. He came to learn, I would think. You know, so don't try to just either impress or feel the need to always talk about what you would do or why you did this or what you've done, because you're there for the instructor. That's not saying the instructor isn't more important. That's not saying that the instructor has got more value in what he's saying. See, you know what you already know. You're trying to get what the instructor knows. And if you're always trying to talk about what you know, you're cutting out a lot of your time and a lot of the reasoning of what the conversation goes to, because you're not getting to what the instructor knows. It seems pretty counterintuitive, but there's been a lot of students that I've had have been just like that. The other thing that I've noticed on a couple of students, and the only student that I ever know that's just really not been happy, is he showed up to take instruction thinking that there were some type of secrets that I was not telling him, or that the professionals kept to themselves, or he was looking for something, you know, like, I don't know what he was looking for. You know, you show him everything you do, explain how you run the line, how you manage your time, why the equipment you're using, where to put the traps in different situations, different things like that. But it wasn't magical enough for them to figure it out. And guys, there is no real trapping secrets. What they are is there's general trapping procedures, and then you get to the detailed part that usually makes a lot of difference. And to someone that maybe doesn't have as much experience when it comes to doing some of this trapping stuff, they don't see the real value into the real detailed technical reasons of why you're doing certain things at certain on certain sets at certain locations. Because they view it, it seems to me, almost as it's just another technique, it's just another way of doing something. And a lot of times, it's not. It's a way to actually ramp up the success at a particular set when you're putting it that way. So, you know, but if you're looking for a secret, there isn't one. I mean, there's really not one. You know, the two biggest secrets in trapping is probably knowing the best place to put the trap for the animal come in contact with it, in hard work. That's the two biggest ones. We all know what they are, but we're trying to find some way this makes it so easy, or like there's some super way that you dig a hole with a flat side on one side and a round side on the other that the animal just can't help itself, and it comes up and it gets caught doing it that way, and that's just not realistic. I mean, it's really not. You know, there's not like a magical place to put a trap that's going to catch all coyotes that come up to the set. There's just nothing for that. So those are the two things I've noticed that people that's really hurt. So the main part of the what can students do to hurt themselves, remember, you're going to learn from the instructor, not to impress the instructor, not to convince the instructor that you're better are. Okay, I'll give you a third one, because something just popped in my mind. Whatever your experience is and whatever you actually catch, don't lie about that. Don't do it. Because you're going to get the wrong instruction from that point on. If you come to me and you're wanting to figure out how to go from 150 coyotes to 300 coyotes, that's a very different instructional mindset than someone that's catching 20 coyotes and wants to catch 50 coyotes. Very different. And if you jump ahead to the first one, you're going to be in trouble, because you're not going to know the basics to get there up to that point. The instructor is automatically going to assume, because you're saying you caught 150 when you only caught 20. You know, it's the same thing with raccoons. There's a big difference between catching, 50 raccoons and a couple hundred raccoons. Now, when you jump up to you want to get into 700, 800, 900, 1,200, 2,000 coons in a season, that is crazy, wildly different than someone that's just trying to catch 100 raccoons. I mean, the whole line management, all that other stuff comes into play. Now, if you're thinking that the guy's going to respect you more, so you start pumping up your numbers, you know, he may or may not. You know, to be honest with you, most professionals are not really turned on at that stage in their life by someone else that catches a lot of fur. They know what it means. They know how to do it. It's not the magical, you know, mystical type thing at that point anymore. So that someone else is catching a lot of fur. Cool. No big deal. What can I help you with? You know, that's where it's going to go. So don't lie about what your catch is, because you're going to get the wrong amount of information. And that's totally on you, man. If you do that to somebody, I'm not saying you will, Al, but I'm just saying, if that happens, that the student is asking to get the wrong information. So, and nobody really wants that, I'm sure. And the other thing is, just because someone is trapped for 20 years, for a couple of days or a couple of weeks out of the year, and you give the impression that you're a full-time, hard-charging trapper and this, that, and the other, if you try to do that with words, or you try to regurgitate all the crap that's online of all the different techniques and reasons and stuff like that all the time to the instructor, where you try to give the impression that you know way more about trapping than you actually know in practical sense, you're again going to get the wrong information. And here's a fact, guys, that you need to understand. If you want to have the respect of the instructor, just be honest with him. Absolutely be honest with him. Because most of the time, and I had several students that act like they know more than they do, the first time you put a trap in their hand and tell them to make the set, it's very clear they don't have near the experience that they think they do, or that they're trying to say that they do. And now you're making the instructor almost question the integrity of the one taking the instruction, because now he's trying to figure out how to politely say, okay, you really don't know how to put a freaking trap in the ground, so let's get that started first. And to the guy that in his mind has blew himself up to be, you know, fire breathing, you know, trapper that's conquering the world, and really he struggles with putting a trap in the ground and getting the set going and everything else, you know, there's conflict going on there, and it doesn't flow very well. There again, why are you taking the instruction? If it's to impress the instructor, send him an email or something. If you're going to pay him money for instruction, take the instruction. But be honest with him about what you're, because most guys will end up handing you a trap to have you put in a set. Now, the way I do this, because I've had that happen so many times, and you can talk to people that's taking instruction from me, you know, on the way to going to where we're trapping. We're talking about trapping and sets and, you know, all that, and the weather, and you want a biscuit from Hardee's and all that type stuff. When we show up at the very first place on the piece of property, we get out of the truck, I don't do anything, because I've learned this is so common inside of trappers. I automatically go, okay, catch me a coyote. Well, where do you want? Wherever you want, you think the best place right now that you can see to catch a coyote, put a coyote trap in the ground. What kind of set? Whatever set that you think is the best play to catch a coyote in this particular location is how you need to put a coyote set in. If they ask a question, I don't answer it. If they ask for advice, I won't give it. And what the reason I do that, and it really frustrates a lot of, because you can imagine someone is trying to pump themselves up to be more than they're not on the way to somewhere. Then when you get there, the first thing that happens is all of the smoke gets blown away when they have to do something with no guidance whatsoever. And I'm not saying this to be mean, guys. This is the way that I've learned to deal with this. So if someone gets out of the truck, and it's clear that they're used to putting in traps and bedding the traps right, and it doesn't look like a monkey screwing a football digging a dirt hole, and you know they can't figure out exactly how the best way to get the stake the set off and all that type stuff. What that does for me, for instructor, no matter what the student says, I know now where we need to start. Well, it's let me show you a couple different ways to bed that trap a little bit tighter. You know, because on the way down, the student's like, you know, the most important thing of the trapping is to bed the trap right. Well, when you watch someone do it and they can't do it, now you know where you need to start. Regardless of what comes out of their mouth, the actions is more important. I wish we'd be more like this in politics. Quit listening to politicians and actually watch what they do. Totally different view on who's a good politician, who's a bad politician at that point. So what I've done is I've turned the tables on the student. So regardless of what is said, I can start from a particular position. But the reason I went to that extreme, and it's very uncomfortable for a lot of guys to do that, and I know that it is, and I'm not doing it out of meanness, but the reason I went to that extreme is so many of the trappers try to exaggerate their skills and their skill levels that this way it just takes it all off the table and show me, don't tell me. So regardless if your instructor does that or not, be honest. That's the best thing you could do. You know, don't try to impress him. So that's, but this is the right question to ask, Al. It really is. And those two things right there, if you will, you know, have what you need to have happen to begin with, then all of a sudden then you're going to have the right answers that you're looking for. And if you're honest with the guy, he knows where to start you out with. Because, guys, there's no shame in someone trying to figure out how to go from 20 coyotes to 50 coyotes. There's no shame in that at all. Because I was there. Every single person that you watched a DVD on or read an article from or claims to be the biggest, baddest trapper in the land, if they're even close to half of what they say, they were exactly where you are at one stage. We didn't crawl out of the womb catching 300 coyotes or 100 bobcats. Didn't happen. So there's no shame in that. And they understand that you're coming to learn. You know, so just keep that in mind when you're thinking about such a thing. So we're going to get the other email. And this is one I've got to be kind of careful on. Okay, this is from Jerry. Okay, thanks for the podcast. I'm really enjoying them, and they keep me connected with trapping throughout the dog days of summer. Like Chips says, I think it's more of a thinking show than anything else. On one of your last podcasts, you mentioned humane pads for your traps. If you don't mind asking, what are these and where do you get them? I'm trapping for the live market here in Arkansas and looking for different options, searching for what works best for me. Okay. Humane pad, the only place I know to get it right now, and I'm sure there's someone else, but I think he actually owns this now, is Keith Winkler at Sterling Furs. And you'll need to call up. I don't even know if it's in his catalog. And whenever I've done that, I can always buy him a case at a time. So I know he either owns them or is a major distributor for whoever makes them. I think he owns them, though. I think he bought these guys out, but I'm not sure. But Keith Winkler at Sterling Fur. He's out of Ohio. You can look him up online. He's at most of the conventions. Sterling Fur's been around forever. You know, Keith Winkler, a straight-up guy when it comes to all this stuff. So, you know, a good guy to deal with. Now, saying that, what are they? What they are is a piece of junk. Now, I'm not... For what you're thinking they're for, I have a feeling. What they are is they feel and look like they're made out of the stuff that you make, like jigs and not the metal part, but the rubber part of jigs and plastic worms for fishing. They seem a little harder than that, but not much. And they come with zip ties to hold them on. So what they are is this, if you can imagine, see, how can I describe this? They're about as long as a number three size trap. They've got like little ridges and they're kind of smooth on one side and they're hollow on the back side. So the premise is you put the hollow end over the steel part of the trap, and the part that comes in contact with the animal is the rubber part, so steel's not touching the animal, and you zip tie them on. Now, state of Tennessee says that's legal. That's the reason I use them. The state of Tennessee says that they're legal is the reason that I use them. Now, the reason that I use them is because I have to use something. I don't have rubber jaw traps. I've got traps. Because I've traveled so much, having an inventory of rubber jaws for Tennessee and having other traps for everybody else did not make any sense to me. So that's the reason I have them, is because I have to, in the state of Tennessee, have something. State says they're legal. Now, do they give you the protection of a rubber jaw trap? In my opinion, no. Because what happens is the first thing that a coyote's going to do, or a fox for that matter, when you catch them, before they start fighting the trap, they don't know what's going on. And in the world of an animal, when something bites you, which is what they think the trap's doing, they bite it back. Now you've got, I mean, just imagine if you give your dog that's upset or agitated a rubber fishing worm, what's the shape of that rubber fishing worm in like 2 seconds? Think about that. Now, plus you're putting it on with these little bitty zip ties, and I do mean little bitty zip ties. So when the animal first gets in it, it pulls. Because it is not physically held onto the trap with the metal straps like a rubber jaw is, like you can get the kits or you can get them already made, there's a tendency for it to roll. Now, this is one of those things in life that I hope we're all grown up enough to understand. You have laws that make sense, and you have laws that have nothing to do with morality or anything else like that, that are pretty much irrelevant in the scheme of anything as far as being ethical or moral. The reason we have them, well, I thought we was going to get rid of the rubber jaws, because when the BMPs come out, the Canadian Modified Number 3s destroyed the rubber jaw trap myth about being less damaged. But for political reasons in the state of Tennessee, they kept the rubber jaw so they can feel good when someone calls up, you know, that's not a trapper and goes, well, how do we do this? You know, is there trapping going on? Hey, we use rubber jaw traps, you know, as they're stroking the back of their hair and they're getting them some ice cream. And just think about it. We don't even use steel traps. We have rubber jaw traps. We're so nice in Tennessee, you know. Oh, yes. You know, we got the animals' best interest at heart. No, it's for political reasons. For a soccer mom not to get as upset because we use rubber jaws. Now saying that, it doesn't work as good as a rubber jaw, which didn't work as anywhere in the same league as a Canadian Modified Number 3 Bridger. Base plated, offset, four cold, and double laminated. So I'm using them because this is where I've got to be careful about what I say. I use them because they're legal in Tennessee and they say if they use rubber of some kind and that meets their standards. Now, luckily for me, and you're going to have to read between the lines on this because I'll never admit this, especially on a radio podcast, there are no instructions on the best way to put those on the jaws. I do not want them rotating the way that they do if you do them the way that is not given instruction for, but makes sense of how you put them on. So if you put them on the opposite way, I am legal in the state of Tennessee because I have a device on there. And since there's no instructions and I went to a government school, I can plead ignorance. If you follow what I'm saying between the lines. So am I technically using humane pads? Yes. Is it really using humane pads the way that I do it? According to a lawyer, yes. But, I mean, just kind of keep that stuff in mind a little bit about what I'm saying. So, it makes a big difference. Being in Arkansas, I would go with the heavy laminated, double laminated, four cold, offset, base plated thing. The reason the base plate is important because it doesn't allow the jaws to bow. If it bows, you're going to get cutting, which is going to hurt you in your live market. If you don't double laminate it, you have a better chance of getting cut. That's why you want the double lamination. It's like an extra insurance policy type thing when it comes to that. The four cold, which is way stronger than you actually need to hold the coyote, does not allow the foot to move from side to side in the jaws. It grabs it like a vice and does not let go. If the foot can't move, the foot can't get cut because it's sliding back and forth. See, all these things add up. Now, where would the humane pad fall into all that goodness? Nowhere. I use it because I have to in the state of Tennessee use something. And since I don't have instructions, I use it the way that I think is best. So that's all I'm going to say about that. Now, the last thing I'm going to talk about, and I'm not going to talk very much because I could spend a whole show on this, guys, and I might end up doing that down the road. Meat Trapper on Trapping Radio, if you hadn't heard it, go listen to it. When you do that, put a flak vest on and a helmet to what your views are from trapping. Because there's been some emails, and one of the ones I've sent two back to today, and I haven't seen what responded to it yet. Meat Trapper ruffled some feathers. But I want to just talk about that just a fuzz. Okay. Meat Trapper is just as much a trapper as someone that traps for ADC or for fur. Just as much of a trapper. He promotes trapping. He wants people to trap this, that, and the other. He values what he does from trapping different than we value as a fur trapper from the fur part of it. That doesn't mean that one is more right than the other. And I know as trappers, anybody that does not agree 100% with the fur trapping mantra is easily seen as an enemy. Now, one of the emails that I've got, and I know you listen to the show, I am not beating up on you at all. To me, conversation is good. I know that you were upset a little bit when you sent at least that first email. I'm not beating up on you, but I do want to bring out a few points, which I've already did in that email. He looks at the food value of trapping. That's where he is putting the value. Now, to him, because that's where he puts the value, he doesn't value the fur the same the way that a fur trapper values the fur. Just as the same as a fur trapper does not value the meat 99.9% of the time. That does not mean that one is better than the other. That does not mean that he is anti-fur by any stretch of the imagination. It's a different view on trapping. It is a more, I think, practical view in the world that we live in today. And I'm going to give an example here in a second to show you why. Now, he's going to be talking about it from a fur and survival point of view. That's what he is. He is a prepper, he is a survivalist, and he traps for food. Nowhere in his agenda is it pro-fur. The way that we are pro-fur. That doesn't mean he's anti-fur. That just doesn't mean it. The same way that an ADC trapper or the fur trapper that we talked about beaver earlier thinks less about fur because he's trapping them in the summer and they're not going to have the same amount of value. You see what I'm saying there? Most people, when they hear anything that does not openly with fan raving support of a total agenda that they have, they automatically go negative with it. And I'm asking you not to do that. It's just a different value. He's valuing a different part of the animal that he's trapping. That's all that it is. It's also a way that I think that he can bring some people into trapping that are confused about what trapping is now on the survival side, where they think that they're going to go out and catch animals with sticks and twigs and string. And the nonsense of most of that stuff is to bring them into that. Now, what does that have to do with fur trapping? It is trapping, guys. That's what it is. And we need to be honest with ourselves in the world that we live in today. Like, one of the things, and I've already said this in the email, so I'm not saying anything to you that I haven't said. I'm not beating up on the email or anything like that. Was he didn't talk about the value of the fur to keep warm. Well, where the emailer came from, and I used to live there, it's really freaking cold. Winter is like 10 months out of the year, damn near. That is culturally part of the area, and it's Alaska. So in that part of the world when it's 60 below zero, yes, I want my seal and sea otter hat, which I wear maybe 3 days a year here. If the wind's blowing really hard and it's 0 degrees, I put it on just so my little ears don't get cold. But I don't wear it around all winter because I would absolutely die, you know, from heat exhaustion. But in that part of the world, which is a very, 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 very small part of the population of Americans, and even when you look at the population of Canada that looks at stuff that way, in the world that we live in today, that's such a small part. Now, is it good for survival purposes? Absolutely. And one of the statements in there, which I think was an amazing statement that he said in the email. Now, I'm not saying a negative way. I think positively is an amazing statement. And because I've thought the same thing many, many times in my life. Fur is an amazing resource that we waste millions of every year. That's like having a bunch of oil in the ground and not going to get it. It just doesn't make sense. And we as trappers see the resource value of the fur because it is. But the bottom line, guy, is just because the resource has value, if there's no market for the resource on a big scale of any kind, does it really have the value that it should? No. Should it be more valuable? Absolutely. Most people are very confused about fur when it comes to them wearing it. And it's not just the South. You don't walk around New York City or upstate New York and people are walking around in full Wolverine vest and fur hats all over the place. Do you see some? Yeah, it's more of a trinket type thing or more of a something like that. It's not part of an everyday attire that someone would wear. It's just not. Now, should it be? Yes. Is it? No. Is the resource valuable if we use it the way that we should? Absolutely. But we don't. There's not a market for it, even though we think there should be. Now, the food value of a lot of things with like beaver, bobcats, raccoons, muskrats, things like that, that is a different value. See, a fur trapper will look at an animal and see the fur and throw away the carcass. A meat trapper keeps the meat, throws away the fur a lot of times, or gives the fur away. Now, one, they'll each stand on each side of this line that does not really exist and say one is more right than the other one. And that's just not the case. It's a different view. Like if you go to an ADC conference, those guys have no earthly idea why people trap for fur. Now they're trappers. They trap just as much and actually more than most fur trappers. But they're not fur trappers. To them, the value is the damage that they get paid for when they go screw something up. That's the value they have. Now that doesn't mean that fur trappers and ADC trappers should be enemies, nor should meat trappers and fur trappers be enemies. We're just looking at a resource from a different point of view. And the way that I want to end the program, I want to give you a marketing platform. I'm going to give you two, and I did the same thing in the email, so that I'm not blindsiding anybody here. Okay, you have a fur trapper. And see, I think one of the biggest mistakes from the fur trapping side is they keep it as a sport or a hobby. Even if it is to the person that's doing it, the perception should never be a sport or a hobby. How in the world do you justify you go out and you kill something for sport, even though you can sell some of the fur? Now, I'm not talking to you and me. I'm talking to everybody else. Go walk up to 100 different people today and ask them if it's okay to kill an animal just because you think it'd be cool to have its hide. Look at the response you're going to get from that. Whether it should be or shouldn't is irrelevant. It is. That's just the way that it is. So keep that in mind. And so you're from a fur point of view, we're going to look at this from the way that the fur trapping industry is trying to survive in the modern world. What we do, for the most part, and anybody that, if you can say there are professionals that make a living trapping, anybody can look at a lot of different stuff online and realize that that is not the case. It is a very small percentage of trappers that actually do this stuff for a living. So that means that most of the people that trap is for hobby or for sport. Now, I think that's personally important. Me personally. But does that mean that the average person, no matter what our personal views are, thinks that that's a very good thing? You know, what if I wanted to have, just change it up a little bit. What if I went and I thought that the best bed cover or the best blanket I could have in my bed comes from a horse, so I just start killing horses to take their hides off and leave the meat to rot in the field somewhere? Well, that'd be on the news in like 10 minutes from that. You know, and most trappers would go, dude, you ain't got to kill a horse to have a bed cover. You know, so it's keep everything in a perspective when we're talking. I see conversation when you have certain ideals that are important to you. And like what I told him, to me personally, I personally think, and I mean this, guys, and I know this is going to ruffle some feathers. If a parent sends a kid to a government school today, it's almost damn near child abuse. Because you're willingly indoctrinating that child to not be as near smart as it should be, and you're teaching it to not be able to think correctly, because that's what the system is going to teach. And that child is going to be pretty much sit in a situation because of going to that school that he's going to be a serf his entire life. And if you don't know what surf means, look it up. I'm not talking about surfing in the ocean. So to me, because I think creative thinking is a huge point, I want people to be successful in their own life. When I see parents send kids to public schools or government schools, as they should be called, and they're indoctrinated their whole life to not be anywhere near their full potential because of the way the system is set up, to me, I don't see how that's not child abuse. Now, I know a lot of parents that send their kids to public schools. None of those people that are doing that are doing it out of meanness or to be abusive to their children. That's just the way that it is. That's an important topic to me. That is not necessarily an important topic to them because they probably never thought about it. Now, I could automatically make judgments towards everybody that sends their kid to a public school, and then I'm going to automatically think negative of them, and that would, to me, would be foolish. Because what's important to me may not be important to them. I don't know their situation. I don't know anything about that. So just because things are important to you and someone doesn't bring up what you think is important doesn't mean that they're the enemy. That's the way through the schools and the way that we do our politics today. If someone doesn't 100% totally agree with you, all of a sudden they're bad, they're the enemy, you should make fun of them, you should shout them down, you should do everything. That's the society we live in today. And it's foolishness is what it is. Dichotomy. Look that up if you don't know what that is. That's the way that we've been trained through the programming of our news to look at every single thing in our life. There's no middle ground. It's either my way or you hate me. You know, so you know, you have to keep that stuff in mind too when you're listening to somebody else that does not have your pet things. But I want to talk about the world that we live in as it is, maybe not the way that it should be, from a point of view. Right now, trapping is a sport or a hobby for 99% of everybody that does it. So the sport or hobby of that is we catch, we kill, and we skin the animals. That's the hobby. In the world that we live in 2016, regardless of what me and you as trappers think about that, most people are going to have a hard time with that. Just like if with me automatically saying, like, I personally, guys, don't understand why horse meat, when there's so many horses starving to death, when people can't feed them, while they're not in the grocery store. But when I've said that to several people, even trappers, their face squinches up and they go, what? You know, to me, having people full is more important than letting an animal starve to death and getting shot and end up in dog food. Because I can tell you, as much as that stuff as I grind up, it smells like it would taste pretty good. By the time I get it, it's not at the point for food at that point. So, you know, it's everybody have a more open view about trappers and allies and different things like that. So from a marketing point of view, today trapping is a hobby or it's a sport. Now, we as trappers, we can talk about diseases and we can talk about this and we can talk about whatever we want. It's a hobby or it's a sport. how in 2016 are you gonna protect a hobby or sport that kills? It's a blood sport, if that's the way that people perceive it. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me that way. Now, if we want to keep trapping, maybe we need to think about things in a little different view and have some different ways that we look at things. Now, I'm not going to go into a big thing of this. I'm reading a book right now, and it is a business book, and it's talking about communication and building organizations and stuff like that. I'm not going to get in a big thing about this. Women's rights, whether you like that or not, and the right to vote for a woman, whether you think that's right or wrong, for about 70 years was stalled out. Black people having the right to vote, whether you think that's right or wrong, is irrelevant in this conversation. Black people couldn't get the right to vote because it was stalled out about the same amount of time. During the same time period, a lot of people thought that women should have the right to vote, but didn't think black people did. A lot of people thought that black people shouldn't, and women did. Now, neither one of those groups could actually get any traction, and one of the people of the groups that couldn't get traction, Susan B. Anthony, which probably some of y'all know that name, they could not get any action because whenever they tried to talk to another group or think about another concept, if it wasn't 100% in line, completely up and down on a checklist, they disregard, wouldn't have anything to do with them. Now, one of the ladies during the suffrage movement, was what that was called, with the women trying to get a right to vote, she saw that maybe having some people that had a little bit different views but were going to meet the same goal was not a bad thing. And believe it or not, the women's right to vote and a black's right to vote would have never come to pass if those two groups would have not got together. Now, the end result was any human being that's an American citizen should have the right to vote. The dichotomy of the way people thought, they wanted to separate white people and black people and male and female. And by their self, being completely pure in everything that they thought that everybody else should think about, and that was considered a very radical thing at the time. And in case you don't realize this, trapping is very radical today in our society. Those two radical ideas could not get any traction until they combined. Now, Susan B. Anthony and her group did not combine, and they floundered forever. It was a very big disappointment. Now, another lady saw that their end goals were the same, even though some of the particulars may not have been, because it was two different things. They got together, and lo and behold, now black people and women both have the right to vote. Because they could see that not everything has to be strictly up and down. We see it in politics today. He's not strong on the border, screw him. You know, but he's not strong on taxes, screw him. We see that crap all the time. I mean, that's just the way we've been taught to think as Americans. So we're going to look at this from a marketing point of view. We've got trapping the way we do it today as a sport or a hobby. That's the way that is perceived because that's actually what it is. And that's the way we do it. Now, that's the marketing campaign of today. That's what it is. We do it because we love it and it's heritage and we do all that. Okay, it's still a sport or a hobby. It's killing something for sport or a hobby. That's being blunt, and that's the way that a soccer mom in 2016 is going to look at it. Now let's look at, from a marketing point of view, let's let the trapping industry run with that one. Let them put some commercials up on TV and some billboards and different things like that and let them run that. You know, for a hobby, we kill stuff. And some of us make some money on all of us, and some of us make enough money to pay back our hobby. So basically, you know, we're killing enough stuff to pay for killing for some stuff. However you want to word that, you can play with that however you want to. That's the trapping industry today. Now, I'm going to come up with a marketing campaign for trapping that I think is way more viable. Trapping is an industry, and is an industry that's been around in America since the beginning of America. And there's a lot of history and tradition involved with that. There's a lot of people's incomes that are based off of that. There's a lot of people that make money from trapping. There's a huge industry in supplying trapping. Not only is the trappers today the same as the trappers of yesterday, they also do a lot of things like they get animals into zoos for your kids to see. Besides that, yes, they do keep the fur. But did you know that a lot of trappers also eat the meat that they catch? they find it better for them than buying industrial raised food. So they have an opportunity to eat wild meat that is not chemically, has not been injected with chemicals, it has not been mistreated, it's only had 1 8-hour or 1 day bad in its entire life. They have the option at that point that they can feed their family with it if they so choose, or they can help other people that need food to get the animal. Now think about the two marketing points of that. Now see, I can keep going on and on and on with this. I can talk about there's also an industry from trapping to get help get away from chemicals. And since natural farming, which is actually trapping because we don't have to have fences or feed them or do anything like that, we let them have the most natural life they can have up until we harvest. We can talk about the different parts of that's actually recycling. We can talk about that there is a shelf life on animals in that natural resource. We can talk about there's an industry that's built up on growing better soil for farmers by using what is left over after the fur, after the meat, you know, and all that. There's an industry, so we're using every single bit of that animal to the very 10th degree. We're respecting that animal completely. We're licensed. We have training. We self-regulate ourselves to use the best traps, and there's a very easy argument to be made on that because look at 1900s and look at today. We're very specific on what we catch. We have certain times that we go trapping, so the most value part of that animal can be brought out. All this can go, and you know, we can use the word organic, we can use natural, we can use natural farming, we can do all that. All that into a marketing campaign is going to whoop the dog snot out of what we do today because it's just a hobby. So combining the different things, and we didn't even get into the ADC side of it, where it's protecting people's homes and children, you know, and their investment of their property and all, you know, keeping crops from flooding out from beaver. I mean, you can go on and on with this, guys. Trapping is a big tent. It is a huge tent. And it is not all about the fur. Our section that most of us that listen to Trapping Radio, we think about the fur because that's important to us. Now, Meat Trapper thinks about the meat because that's important to him. An ADC Trapper thinks about the check because someone's got a raccoon that's peeing all over the insulation in the roof of their house. The trapper that goes out and catches stuff either for scientific research or to put in a zoo is not thinking about the meat nor the fur or the damage that animal is causing. You know, we have an aquarium in Tennessee. It's full of otter. They all came from North Carolina, and they probably all came from Claudie Taylor. He didn't skin it, and he didn't eat it, and it wasn't causing a problem. You know, then you got the survival side of things, which is a totally different thing, but under the same tent. Right now, we've got hundreds of thousands of people that look around the world that we live in today. Economically, it's screwed up. Ethically, it's screwed up. Governmentally, it's screwed up. A common sense person with any type of rational thinking realizes that it's going to eventually get very bad before it's starting straight out again, and they're looking at a different way than maybe look at the food. Now, if all those people started looking at beaver from a point of view of meat instead of just fur, or meat and fur, or meat and fur and glands that they can sell to me, or meat, fur, glands they sell to me and fertilizer in their garden, or they come up with a way to break that down, or they can make bone sauce to sell to orchards. I mean, I can go on and on, stacking functions with an animal that you catch. All those hundreds of thousands of guys that are out there, which is way bigger than the trapping fur industry, way bigger as far as population goes. If they start looking at trapping from the point of view to use modern techniques and different things like that, and they get away from the sticks and strings of just the way that they look at of how they're going to primitively catch something. Now we've expanded the whole part of trapping into even a bigger tent. Now see, this is playing chess instead of checkers when it comes to trapping. Right now, the trapping industry is playing a very basic version of checkers. That's what they're doing. And eventually, guys, if we don't allow other views of trapping, inside of trapping, where we don't beat each other up like it's political, you know, like you can sit here and watch Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, where they're both socialists and they both have the same end game in mind, beat each other up the way that they do. That's the way we can do it in trapping, or we can not do it that way, and I hope we don't do it that way. The end result is if we don't have a bigger tent, where we have more pull in the United States, where an average soccer mom can look at trapping from a totally different view from a sport or a hobby, trapping will become just like it is in Europe. Yes, there's trapping in Europe, and the only people that do it are government trappers. Because once society finally focuses on trapping again, it wouldn't be very hard with the politicians that we have and the limp-wristed little weakly spined people in all our states to, instead of having people scream at them about how bad the trapping animals for sport is, they can figure out a way to start a government organization just like they did in Europe. And that actually gives them more power, because now they have more employees, they get more federal money, they get to raise taxes. Everything in their world is hunky-dory if there's not any private trappers. The worse they are, the more money they'll get. Look at TSA. Look at Homeland Security. The more they screw up, the more money they get, the more power they get over everybody else. So that works in the government's way of thinking. The worse it is, the more money we get, so everybody's happy, except the people that actually need the service. So what I'm asking you to do is to not be so quick to automatically jump on somebody else that's looking at trapping in a different way. Because I can promise you, meat trapper is the farthest thing from an anti you will ever meet. He probably, I won't even say probably, I guarantee you, he makes, his political views make Donald Trump about three steps away from Bernie Sanders. He believes in freedom. He believes in using outdoor stuff. He believes in resources. He believes in everything. Now, I'm not saying that, so you don't send him me letters, emails if he pisses you off. Send them to him. He's a grown man. He can handle it. But the only thing I am cautioning you on is he'll probably respond in a way that you're not going to like, as far as he is a very logical and methodical and rational person. That's part of the reason I like him. Now, we're both trappers. That's another reason that I like him. Now, do we do the same thing with all of our catch the same? No. If this is a way that could make the tent of trapping better, so we can actually have the ability that we have today to go out trapping, maybe longer if we get another, you know, 200,000-300,000 people involved, because in the trapping, on the survival side of things, he's got a very good following over there. Is that a bad thing? No. Is it all going to be about the fur? No. It's about trapping. To me, that's the most important thing, is the trapping. That's me personally. Selling the fur is something that you do when all of the other part is said and done. To me, the joy of trapping is figuring out how to go trap an animal and do it successfully and do it repeatedly. That's to me what is the most important. It's not the fur part of it. Do I want to sell fur? Absolutely. Do I like eating beaver meat and bobcat? You better believe it. I don't see why the two can't come together. And the only reason I'm going through this, which may seem like somewhat of a rant, is we don't need to beat up on other trappers or automatically think negative thought of other trappers if they don't have the exact same views as we do. Because it's detrimental to trapping. It's you can look around the world you live in now. It's detrimental to about everything you can think of. That's the reason the world's in such a mess. So that's my thoughts anyway. So just keep that in mind, guys. All right. See y'all next week.